So when we think about gut health, we're thinking about the anatomical problems, right? So whether someone has whether they have breakdown of their gut lining, whether the bacteria in their large intestine is, which we'll touch on a little bit, like dysbiotic. So there's an imbalance there. So think about that as the function. When we think about actual digestion in of itself, it's taking in the foodstuffs that we eat, and then our ability to be able to break it down, digest it, and assimilate it within our cells is obviously a huge factor in our overall health, right? And there's all these roadblocks that occur in digestion that we may not know about. And that's what we're going to go through first. Then we'll talk about where overall gut health can go wrong. Then we'll talk about what we can do to help. And we'll pick out some really clear things, right? So we'll pick out some really, really effective things that we can do, like right now. And then we can think about some of the more slightly more advanced stuff if we need to go through those as well. Like I said, any questions, especially at the end, if it's about the presentation, stop me whenever. If it's something else you want to go through around diet, nutrition, mindset, whatever it is, at the end, no problem. I'm more than willing to hang around for as long as you guys are willing to listen to me speak. The stages of digestion are really important and they're really basic, right? And the one that you guys have so much more control over than you think you do. It's generally like you call phase one. It's the cephalic phase of eating. And like if you type in the cephalic phase online, it'll generally just come up as like chewing your food, right? Don't get me wrong, that plays a role. And your ability to be able to like make a bigger surface area for your food makes it easier down below for everything to be digested effectively. But when we look at the cephalic phase in its entirety, it's our ability to be able to sit, relax, and digest our food effectively. And like the best way to think is what Matt's put in the 5, 10, 15, 20 method with that. But why is that the case? When, and it'd be interesting to see, and don't hesitate, we all do this, who eats their food at the same desk or in the same place where they work? Just put it in the chat, yes or no. Where is the chat? There it is. Lewis, yeah, often. Yep. Guilty. Now, when you think about that, what's that got associations to? For most of us, for not all of us, some of us absolutely love our jobs and it doesn't cause us stress. But exactly. Thank you, Matt. That causes stress. We should not be in a stressful scenario when we eat food. So you take yourself away from that. Who watches reruns of Donald Trump's assassination when they're eating their food? Getting stressed, getting riled up about stuff that you see on television. So whether that's the news, whatever it may be, right? I've learned to pull myself away from that kind of stuff. We eat quicker. That's very true. So that's unconscious eating. We eat way quicker. That's a really good point, Ross. Thank you for that. But they're all stressful environments. We have to remove ourselves because what happens when we get stressed? Digestion, to a certain extent, almost shuts down. Almost, not fully, right? Because our body will start to make different priorities in that circumstance. So when we're stressed, we perceive threat. So blood flow will get pulled away from your intestines and will go to our limbs in preparation for whatever that stress may be, to fight or flight, right? Whereas when we're in a parasympathetic tone, when we take deep breaths before we eat, when we're eating with the family, generally eating with the family is a lot less stressful, I would say. It depends on the family, right? But that is when we'll actually get into rest and digest. So when we're in that kind of position, we chew our food thoroughly, we take time between bites, we converse with the people around us. It has a knock-on effect below. Digestion starts from the mouth and it works down. It doesn't work once it goes down your gullet, right? We need to be in a nice position to chew food and to allow the rest of the stuff to happen because then it allows phase two to start. It allows phase three to start. It allows phase four to start. Because when we think of stomach acid and acidity, this is the first stage of what you would call chemical digestion. Technically, some happens in the mouth with carbohydrates, right? But when you're thinking about protein in particular, most of it is broken down in your stomach, right? And it begins the degradation or the denaturing of it. But it's really important because you see this in females all the time. First of all, they don't eat enough red meat. They tend to have lower stomach acid than men, and they tend to be anemic. So, like, we don't digest iron effectively. We don't digest B12 effectively, vitamin C, zinc, all these vitamins that are necessary for us to be able to get big and jacked and produce energy, right? We need to be able to break down our proteins effectively, and it starts here. When you get like horrible stomach infections called like the H. pylori, which doesn't get checked very often anymore, but is relatively common. It's the most common communicable disease in the world. A lot of people have it, but you see that those people tend to become anemic because H. pylori lowers stomach acid, right? It's a big deal. And stomach acid will knock on and cause the release of small intestinal digestive enzymes. This is very much a top-down issue. Starts with cephalic phase. It's secondly, then you'll see the release of hydrochloric acid, then digestive enzymes, then you'll get gallbladder and bile to digest fat, right? So within when we release digestive enzymes, they break down all the different kinds of macronutrients, proteins, fats, and carbohydrates in preparation for digestion. When you find these molecules, if you find like when we think of proteins, they're just strands of amino acids stuck together. When they get into the small intestine, they're not broken down properly, they're still in these strands of amino acid, and the immune system responds to that, and not in a positive way. Doesn't respond to individual strands, or individual amino acids. So it has to be broken down effectively. And I think obviously one of the phases that we have the most control of is this cephalic phase. But understanding that it affects is everything downstream. Now, as we age, stomach acid tends to go down. As we age, digestive enzymes tend to go down. Bile, a little bit different, not always an effective way to approach it. Oops. But think about digestion and separate it sometimes from actual digestive physiological function. And that's it. Think about it. It's just a straight tube from mouth to anus, right? It's a straight run, and we need to digest our food within that time. But where can it go wrong? This is where you'll start to see some of the symptoms that happen outside of the gastrointestinal system. Intestinal permeability, leaky gut is actually becoming really popular. Popular in the sense that they're talking about it. You'll see it out in the Twitter sphere quite regularly now, whereas we didn't see it before at all. But I guess functional medicine people were talking about this in the 60s. It was wildly discredited, but it is very legitimate now. And all it is the breaking down of the single-celled gut lining in your small intestine, mostly. It can happen in your large intestine. And people will think, right, within your small intestine, where you digest the vast majority of your food, why would it only be one cell? They're called columnar cells, and they're just stacked, but it's very much a single cell, right? Just a heads up on that presentation screen. It's still showing the full Canva dashboard. Are you guys all seeing the full Canva dashboard here, or is this just full presentation in front of you?
It's the dashboard, Chris.
Huh. So can you, that's strange. So
There we
you guys
go.
are seeing it like with like my full Safari screen on
Correct.
it. Oh.
I thought you were just being mean with the Parmesan cheese over there on the side.
Parmesan cheese on the side.
Yes.
Oh,
Yes.
this. Oh, thanks for the heads up, Matt. I appreciate it. I don't know why that's happening. I'll try put it into full presentation view again and see if it works. Otherwise, I can make it something like that. Has that worked, or is it still the same?
Well, we can't. The Parmesan cheese is gone, so your presentation is now dairy free. But
But it
we can.
hasn't gone full screen, has it?
Yeah, no, it's not quite full screen.
Okay. There must be
That's,
something
but
wrong.
we can see the slides though. If you just, yeah, just rock and roll, man. We got it.
Yeah, we'll make this big enough. That's all right. Yeah, so sorry, when you look at intestinal permeability, why would it be like a, why would it just be a single cell? It's because your gut has to be semi-permeable, right? Because we have to be able to take food or food molecules across to be assimilated within our body. So it has to be semi-permeable. That's why it's got this really thin layer between everything we eat and our entire immune system. But it can go really wrong where it becomes not selectively, but permanently permeable. And some of the symptoms that you might see, some of the gastrointestinal symptoms that you generally see with these people, frequency of food reactions, unpredictable food reactions, aches, pains, and swelling is a big one. Unpredictable abdominal swelling, frequent bloating and distension after eating, right? The classical ones that you tend to see. But think about the other stuff. What are the symptoms that are indirect? Eczema, psoriasis, mood disorders, immune disorders, autoimmune disease, hormone imbalances, obesity, and fatigue are all associated with intestinal permeability. If you were to go onto PubMed, which is where you'll see all the scientific research, if you type in intestinal permeability and any of the diseases of Western civilization, so if you look at type 2 diabetes, cancer, cardiovascular disease, and neurodegeneration, they'll all have an association with leaky gut. When you look at most diseases of inflammation, which most of them are, they'll have some of this involved in it, right? So it's a big deal that can't be ignored. And it's becoming more commonly accepted in Western medicine now that this is a problem for a lot of people. And I know I just put in mood disorders, but the number one symptom for people outside of their digestive symptom, outside of their digestive system, is depression, right? So unregulated depression, so like, or depression that is not affected by medication, can be associated with intestinal permeability. So a big deal. And then you get all the random array of things that can cause it. So if you're diabetic, you got stress. Everybody's got stress. Your ability to be able to resist stress, obesity, sleep deprivation plays a big role here. Dysbiosis, pesticides, food intolerances, alcohol intake can be a big one, right? So there's a lot of different things. But for most people, most normal people, I know the vast majority of people who come into MI are not normal. You're all normal, but I mean normal in terms of the food that you eat, comparable to general population. But highly processed diets can cause this. One of the things I didn't put in here was medication. If you have a history of the use of a lot of pain meds, for sure this can be an issue. Okay. Now, what can you do? What's the cure? Removing or reducing the underlying cause. So, if you're a chronic smoker, for example, can cause this issue as well. If you take a lot of pain medication, this can cause issues here, right? If you have food intolerances, like if you're celiac and you still eat gluten, there's an issue, right? Whole unprocessed food diet, there's loads of different options and they get more aggressive, right? So, you can use a paleo diet, low FODMAP, autoimmune paleo. You can look those up online. They tend to have benefits in these circumstances. And then we talked about food triggers, whether it's gluten, dairy, lectins, nightshades. Food rotation is important. If we eat the exact same foods all the time, I particularly think in this in terms of vegetables for most guys, we don't rotate our vegetables enough. 2 points for anybody. Does anybody here genuinely eat more than five different types of fruit and vegetables? And I'll give you what the research says you probably should be doing. Josh, nice. 4 to 5. So The research suggests that the best way to get the best diversity within our gut, and don't get me wrong, that's the same with me the vast majority of the time. I'll have periods in my life where I'll be really particular and try to diversify, and then I'll just go back to normal over time. But when we look at it realistically within a week, for the most diversity, it's 30 different types of fruit and vegetables a week. Not saying that you guys have to do that. That's not the goal. But if you're doing, like Ross just said, three fruits plus 4 to 5 different veg. So let's just say 8 in total. Diversify that, take it to 10, take it to 12, whatever it may be. But just looking for a little bit more each week in terms of diversity. And then you can look at like supplementation. I don't like jumping straight to supplementation, but if you have symptoms of leaky gut, like replacing enzymes and HCL where necessary, but vitamin A, D, zinc, colostrum, glutamine, probiotics like S. boulardii and spore-based probiotics. You can ask me, like, if any of you guys think you have an issue with this, you can drop me a message and I'll be a little bit more specific about dosages and things like that. But using supplementation here can be really beneficial. Like short chain fatty acids can be beneficial here as well. Now, when we look a little bit further, when we get down finally into the large intestine, you can think an imbalance in gut bacteria. That's all it is. People hear this word dysbiosis and they don't quite know what it means. It's an imbalance between so-called good and bad bacteria within our gut. We have far more bacteria within our gut than we have our own human cell. And I remember listening to a lecturer speak about this, and he kind of put across the point, like, are they living in us or are we actually just living around them? Because they play such a big role in our brain function, in our cardiovascular health, in our longevity, in kidney health, in liver health. And I'll show you in a sec how that happens. But when we get an overgrowth of the what they would call potentially pathogenic bacteria. So some of you might have heard of some of these, like Klebsiella. E. coli is a real classic one that people hear about. It's the first one ever isolated. And they don't understand that we normally have like some of this so-called bad bacteria. It's just that we need loads of beneficial bacteria to keep this within check. Every nightclub you go into is going to have a couple of dodgy people in it. But as long as the bouncers are on point, those people don't tend to cause issues. And you can think about it like that. They keep everything in check. But if you have dysbiosis, what kind of symptoms do you expect to see? A lot of them are really similar, unfortunately. But like the classic one that I always see is feel that the bowels do not completely empty, right? Alternating constipation, diarrhea. Coated tongue or fuzzy debris on a tongue. So you see people that have like what look like white, like they have a white film on their tongues. That's associated with it for sure. And then a lot of the same symptoms or a lot of the same indirect symptoms that we see outside of the gastrointestinal system, but we'll touch on in a sec, like high blood pressure, cardiovascular disease, massively associated here. So it's really important that we have diversity of the beneficial bacteria. And what 2 points out of the macronutrients that we consume, so think carbs, fats, and protein, what feeds this bacteria? If anyone can answer that. Protein, anyone else? Carbs. Carbs. Right. So good answers. And it's actually like Ross kind of brings a point to this, right? Because we all want to eat high protein diets, right? Because we know the benefits of protein, and not just for being jacked, but in terms of immune health, brain health, all the other things that tends to come with a high protein diet. But we don't want amino acids or a high amount of protein getting into our large intestine because most, not all, of the bad bacteria within our large intestine are what are called proteobacteria, which means they eat protein. So when we don't digest, I know we just finished digestion, right? But if we don't digest our proteins effectively, that's what can happen. So you see people with like really bad hydrogen sulfide issues. You see people with a lot of E. coli when they don't digest their foods effectively, right? But the answer for like a beneficial blend would be fiber, right? I take aminos twice a day. Is that bad? So aminos shouldn't be because they're like, if you think about like amino acids, they're already broken down. So you should just absorb those naturally, right? That's kind of like skipping digestion, but in a positive way. So I don't think the aminos would play a big role there. It can, but I doubt it. So they eat fiber. So you think fruits and vegetables, you think like black rice, white rice. You think different types of bread, they've all got fiber in it, or what are called prebiotics. So when they get to the large intestine, they don't get digested normally. They make it all the way to the large intestine, and then the beneficial bacteria eat them, and then they poop out what are called postbiotics, all these really beneficial things called short chain fatty acids, propionate, acetate, butyrate. But these things like regulate the immune system, they regulate the gut lining, they regulate blood sugar, brain health. Like if anyone has ever suffered like a traumatic brain injury, for example, this is important, right? If you've got TBIs and when that happens regularly, traumatic brain injury, just think of it as concussion. What happens to certain people is they lose their blood-brain barrier. So you have this barrier that stops bad things from getting into the brain. We lose that if we get a lot of knocks to the head. Our ability to be able to produce short-chain fatty acids will determine if we can rebuild that or not. So it's super important and it affects so much outside the gut. So you can look at it like this. Every single organ within your body has an axis with the gut. One that's not there, which I'm always fascinated by because I've only got one, it is there's even like a gut kidney axis, right? And I always find it interesting. So really bad gut health can lower our testosterone quite significantly, right? So you can see the gut endocrine axis. Endocrine just means hormones. And it makes you think, why would that happen, right? Because if you've got low-grade inflammation with the gut, which obviously is terrible for longevity and our ability to live a long, healthy life and all those things, but it means when we've got low-grade inflammation, we've got like a relatively heightened immune system. Well, testosterone is immunosuppressive, so it lowers our immune system, right? So if you've got bad gut health, your immune system is responding to that. Why would you take exogenous testosterone and lower your immune system at the same time, right? Or are we missing the mechanism of why your testosterone is low? I'm not against the use of exogenous testosterone, by the way. I think when it's needed, it's definitely needed. But think this side is what you're aiming for. If you want to have a really healthy large intestine, you want to increase the diversity. Diverse list of veg, fruits, and fiber. Diverse meals, sleep, and normal circadian rhythms really play in here. They really do, and they're important. Outdoor activity. You've got to get exposed to different types of bacteria. The biggest mistake that we ever made with our children, with our lifestyle, is we sanitized everything. And that's not how it should be. Like, I can't remember who released the book. Was it Dr. Axe? Eat Dirt. Right. And he's not far off. Like we should be, especially our kids should be, because it primes their immune system and creates a resilient immune system. They should be out in the dirt. We were like, I mean, I'm nearly 40. When I was a kid, feck, I wasn't allowed in the house after school. I had to be outside. Exercise, interaction with pets, man, get a dog. It makes a difference. Kids who have pets tend to grow up to have less intolerances and less allergies. Because they get exposed to a lot of different things than as kids. Also, if anybody's of interest, if anybody has dogs, if you're lonely, if you're sick and you pet a dog, it makes both of those things improve. And that's even if you don't like dogs. That's I find that absolutely fascinating. So dogs just have this special mechanism to make you heal from illness quicker and just make you happy. So forget about the diversity just in general. So lower diversity, you think about these things like same meals every day, sterile environment, lack of sleep, antibiotics and NSAIDs, pesticides. I put a question mark beside artificial sweeteners, right? And there's some research, thanks, Lewis. There's some research that show that high dose artificial sweeteners can cause dysbiosis. I would have a feeling it's in really high dose, though. So, like, if you have one or two Coke Zeros a week, I don't think it's going to be the thing that's going to cause you the biggest problem. Okay. Would it be good to have a cat? Kid, keep asking. So, cats is an interesting one. I've never seen it, but cats tend to be a carrier of much more bad bacteria. So, cats carry something called Toxoplasma gandhi, if anyone's ever heard of it. And what that bacteria does is, well, it's fascinating. It depends if you think it's fascinating. So, when rats get this infection, it makes them, it innervates and gets into their brain, and it makes them sexually attracted to cat urine. So that then, because it obviously wants to move up in terms of size, so then the cat will come and eat the mouse. So I'm not too mad on cats, but also petting cats doesn't do the same thing, so avoid them, I'd say. And there is loads of stuff, but when I think about dysbiotic supplements, different types of fibers can be really beneficial here, like galacto-oligosaccharides. You see, inulin is really popular. Like, these things can be really beneficial. If you're going to use supplemental fiber, be careful to start with, man. Like, because anytime, and I've said this a few times on these calls, if you make big dramatic changes in your diet, you will shit your pants. It's quite a strong possibility, right? If you chuck 10 grams of supplemental fiber and you drink it, you're going to have a really bad time. I can promise you that. So if you're going to use supplemental fiber, it's great. I love it. Start slow, build up. But you can use some of these ones like PHGG's partially hydrolyzed guar gum. That tends to be really soft, so people can tolerate it much better. And then lastly, and the only reason I don't normally bring up the like the types of infections you can get within your gut, which are, like I said, with H. pylori, really common. But when we think about longevity in particular, H. pylori, although initiated in your stomach, they find it in the autopsy of dead people. Well, you fucking, you'd hope they're dead anyway. Where if they've had strokes or if they have calcification of their arteries, if they pull that calcification out, they find H. pylori in it. So it's not just a stomach problem, it spreads out and becomes systemic, right? It's a major issue. And then SIBO is what you call small intestinal bacterial overgrowth. So, like, where we shouldn't have loads of bacteria in our small intestine, most of it should be in our large. If we accumulate it in our small intestine, you'll see it in people who eat stuff like onions, garlic, mushrooms, and they respond really badly because it ferments in their small intestine. They get really bloated and it's not very pleasant, right? So, people can get these infections and they can be a real issue. The reason why I don't normally bring it up is because you normally need some testing. But the problem now, like, Western medicine used to always test for H. pylori because they knew the problems with it. Now they never do. And like some of the real classical stuff for H. pylori is reflux is the classical problem. But like I mentioned, in like unresponsive anemias, definitely. So iron deficiency anemia, constipation is common with H. pylori, diarrhea. You can get constipation or diarrhea with SIBO. And then there's the other thing is like distension, joint pain, cardiovascular disease, right? We'll pass over that. But the treatment for that, it's got to be specific to what the problem is. So that needs testing. So I don't normally go into too much of what can be done there. After eating spicy food, I take meds for it though. Let's actually keep that for the very end, Ross, and we'll go through that. With SIBO, do you recommend going to a GI and getting a specific antibiotic for it? Save that as well. We'll get through that at the very end. Reasons for, and this is just lastly, right? So quickly, there is a reason for IBS. If any of you are out there and you suffer with IBS, generally speaking, there's a reason. So in the big research studies that they do on it, like, don't get me wrong, emotional trauma can be one of them, but like leaky gut, post-food poisoning, infection, parasites, small intestinal fungal overgrowth, small intestinal bacterial overgrowth tend to be the number one reasons why. People always think they have a parasite. I very rarely see really pervasive bad parasites. Right, guys? Sorry, there's a lot of talking from me. Let's hear from you guys. There's a couple of questions I'll go through quick, and then we can get into anything else. You get reflux after eating spicy food. I take meds for it. Ross, how are you doing? So what do you take? Proton pump inhibitors? Like, or is it just Tums?
No, it's a scripted medication. I think it might have been, I don't know if it's called the same in the States, Pariet, Pariet, or rabeprazole or something.
I think that's a PPI. Yeah, it is. So that's a proton pump inhibitor. So that will lower stomach acid, which acutely isn't too much of a problem. Overuse of PPIs, proton pump inhibitors, over long periods of time have really wicked side effects, though. So, like, avoiding the stuff that causes you the issue is really important. So, like, if you look at some of the research, and I'm gonna try and think about it off the top of my head, but for example, bone fractures become way more common in people that use PPIs for long periods of time. I'm gonna remember, I'll find the other research on it, but especially long-term use is a real problem. So you have to either find out why. Spicy food does give a lot of different people reflux. So I wouldn't necessarily think it's H. pylori or an infection, but I would avoid that as much as possible so you can take that medication as little as possible.
Yeah, because I've been taking it for I don't know, probably 3 or 4 years.
But do you
Although
take
I take it at night time before bedtime, although the doctor does say I don't have to take it every night. Yeah, because he says even if you take it every second night, that's fine. But yeah.
Yeah, so like Helio just put in the chat, like they say we need to take it every day. Yeah, because I understand because reflux, the symptom is not nice. So of course you're going to take it to avoid that symptom. But unless you need to find the underlying cause of why you got reflux in the first place, because like I personally, and like I said, I don't rag on Western medicine. Like if I cut my arm off, like I don't want to go see a functional doctor. Fuck, what's he going to do for me? Like we need Western medicine. It's great at a lot of things, but overprescription of protein pump inhibitors, especially for really long periods of time, is to a certain extent neglect because some of those side effects can get really bad over a long period of time. So you can look, obviously, when people tidy up their diet, a lot of their reflux tends to go away. So, like, if you can get away with using it, I would never tell someone to come off PPIs completely straight away because they tend to get this big, massive reaction where they get over acidification and the symptom becomes worse. So you start trying to space it out as much as possible. So if you're taking it every night, can you take it? Can you get away with taking it every second night, for example? And then you can try and spread it out. And then, if you still get a little bit of reflux, you can use stuff like Tums. So Helio asked, with SIBO, do you recommend going to a GI and getting a specific antibiotic for it? The antibiotic they use is called rifaximin. Works really well, clears it really effectively, has a high relapse rate though. That's the general issue with that. So I think it's, don't quote me on it, but it's somewhere between 40 and 50% relapse rate with the antibiotic. I tend to use, if I'm treating someone with SIBO, I tend to use herbal antimicrobials. It takes way longer, but it tends to last. So relapse rate tends to be a little bit less. You won't find in research because they won't do research on that though. If someone doesn't have a dairy intolerance, how much milk can be implemented into a daily diet? Is milk inflammatory or anti-inflammatory? Oh, Des, you do ask the good questions. I would generally look at milk as, I'd say in high amounts. I think it'll change the more you take in. Some people don't respond to dairy at all, and its macro breakdown is really good. So like in terms of protein, carbs, and fats. So if you can tolerate milk and dairy, I generally don't mind people using it. How much? I always say to people to be careful with whey protein and using that consecutively for many, many years. Some of the reasons is it's really concentrated, number one. Secondly, when we think about a protein, so like casein's a protein or the whey protein portion of that, when in nature do you see a protein not backed by fat? It doesn't really happen. So like just isolating a protein and taking that continuously might cause problems. But how much milk? I don't really have an answer directly for you there, but if you don't have issues with it, I don't mind people using milk. Has anybody else got any questions? Yes. What is your stance on fluoride products? It's a good option. Yeah. Yep. Some pendulum. Okay, so Andrew asked a couple of good questions there. What's my stance on fluoride? I generally try to remove it. Fluoride is generally like a waste product, and it's still widely used. Like I'm from Ireland originally, we use a lot of fluoride, and I would generally try and use filtered water in those circumstances. Now, I've never really dug into the research on fluoride. I'm taking that opinion from people who I learn from and respect. So I can't give you too much information on it. What does it do to the gut microbiome? I have no idea. If you want to supplement with fiber, the combination of as many different kinds as you can, genuinely, is really beneficial in that circumstance. But again, be careful, particularly with stuff like inulin. Like inulin's harsh. It's brilliant. It feeds the most of the bacteria, but it can be really harsh on some people. So just be a little bit careful with it. So that's a good question with probiotics. I generally think there's so many strains, right? Like you'll look at like bifidolacto, and then it'll have like longum, it'll have the strain number. There's so many different kinds. Which one do you pick? You're trying to find as many strains as possible, but I like to see it from all the three different families. So the three families are Bifido and Lacto. They're the ones we've seen for years, right? The second strain are soil-based probiotics, and they are what you think they are, probiotics that they find from the soil. And then there's what's called Saccharomyces boulardii, which is a yeast. So the one I tend, I'll get it up quick. The one that I tend to give to clients that has. So this one has a really good blend of spore-based and Saccharomyces boulardii. And I do tend to use this quite regularly with clients. Okay, what are your thoughts on introducing fermented foods to a diet to support growth of good bacteria? Great question, Corey. But remember, probiotics and like beneficial bacteria from fermented foods don't colonize. They'll have their effects when you eat them. So if you've got loads of Bifido and lacto on something like kimchi, it'll do all its cool things as it comes through you, but it won't colonize. It'll support growth because it regulates your immune system. It makes it that they're quite potent anti-inflammatories. So they do loads of really cool things. And they're selectively antimicrobial. So they can actually help kill off bad bacteria. But they don't actually colonize. The only thing that'll help to colonize is fiber. Anybody else got any questions? We still got time. We good? Any questions outside of this? Any issues? Digestion? Doesn't have to be digestion. Diet, nutrition, lifestyle, whatever it may be, training wise. I've been asked this a few times. So next time that I'm on, Des, I will go through the research on this because I've never looked at it. So do I give my clients collagen supplements? Not normally. If I want to use something like, I generally think what builds collagen is what I tend to look for. So like vitamin C, lysine, they tend to be the combination of stuff that actually builds collagen. I've been asked this a few times. Ben always recommends them, and I'm sure he knows well. But I promise next time that I'm on, I'll go through that research and see how beneficial they are. Oh, thoughts on avocado and soft poop. I eliminated it and the run stopped. Well, interesting. That's not a high FODMAP food though. So that's surprising. Now, people do tend to respond not badly to avocado. Is avocado a high FODMAP food? No, it's not. I'm sure it's low. Oh, okay. So half an avocado is considered high in FODMAPs. That's interesting. So that might indicate that you have some issues with FODMAPs. Now, people don't always respond to all of them. So, like the most common ones you see are onions, garlic, and mushrooms, and fructose. But if you're responding badly to avocado, that might indicate that you have some SIBO issues. I know we're getting checked anyway, so we'll be able to figure out what that problem is. That's interesting. You mentioned whey might not be recommended. Oh yeah, so like if people don't respond well to dairy, I tend to give them beef protein powder. I find that the most, I suppose what they call it, like hypoallergenic. So people tend to not respond badly to it. Digestion. Yeah, so that's a good question. Does drinking too much water affect digestion? Technically, yes. So if you take in a lot of water prior to when you eat, it will lower the acidity of your stomach. So it can play a role in some people. A good way to check, like if you're ever worried, use the apple cider vinegar check. So like if you put 2 tablespoons of apple cider vinegar in something and you drink it, if you notice that that dramatically affects your digestion in a positive way, then you might think you might have low stomach acid. Low stomach acid isn't as common as people th once thought. So people are very quick to jump to taking a load of hydrochloric acid. Normally, there's something else going on. But yes, drinking water does.
I have a question for you on the apple cider vinegar. What exactly do you put that in so that it doesn't make your cheeks suck in and hit each other on the middle across your tongue? That stuff, it's crazy. Just my wife's step grandmother, so I don't know how that re translates, but she's awesome. She is successfully beating cancer back, and one of her, she's a very naturalist. She would be, I forget the word, but she's doesn't like Western medicine and she doesn't have to take it. And she came across local honey, and mixing that with apple cider vinegar, and I mean, it probably improved lots of things in her life, but she stands by it. So I've tried it, but man, that stuff is, it's tough. It's tough to get down.
If I use apple cider vinegar, I'll normally put it in like just a small glass of water. It just allows me to neck it then without
Just
having to
yeah.
actually taste it. Yeah. I'm not there for the enjoyment with that. This
Just
is
car bomb it. Yeah, just got
so I'll just try and bomb it like I used to do with a Jägermeister. Like yeah, whey isolate tends to be a little bit better, but it still has the dairy component to it. Not everyone responds badly to them, though. Like, not everyone responds badly to dairy. We went through a phase, like, well, I'm thinking back when I got into this industry 10 years ago, where everyone had to remove gluten and dairy. I don't necessarily think that's the case, but I think people have tolerances to a lot of these different so-called bad foods where they can have some and they tend to react absolutely fine. When they go over a certain threshold, then it tends to cause an issue. But with protein powder, there's nothing wrong with rotating through different ones. So, like, if you wanted to try beef protein for a little while, and then so when you finish what you have, try beef protein then and see if you notice the difference. In a shake form, eat more meat. Genuinely, it's a tricky one, right? So, like, how do you get enough protein in without protein powders? You can look at your combination in terms of vegetables as well. Thanks, Moran. You can look at vegetable combinations. So lentils and beans tend to be beneficial in that circumstances. They tend not to be full blends of amino acids, but they can help. And outside of that, you're looking at like stuff like cottage cheese and stuff can be really beneficial as well. Like, I remember when I wouldn't say I struggled to hit it, but like, you're in the UK, if you don't respond bad to dairy, do you use like skyr yogurt? Fact, it's like 30 grams for half a tub.
Yeah, I use some. Is it feed? Is it Fiji?
Beige similar, isn't it?
Yeah, I use that now and again. But yeah, I usually use milk, and then I use some protein powder. But I'll probably strictly eliminate protein powder now since you said that. But yeah, I'll add some cottage cheese. What about like eggs and stuff? Can I just crack in some raw eggs in there?
So you might find an issue with raw eggs. You can use like, so like what I do if I'm trying to hit it as well, sometimes I use egg whites, but I'll still cook them, but it's not particularly pleasant. Like, so like a scrambled egg or an omelet with egg whites can hit a higher protein target, but I don't like separating the white from the yolk too often. But the problem is when you use the yolk, it just increases your fat. And why I don't like it, what does the egg white balance that the yolk doesn't? You can end up with biotin deficiency, that's what it is. So you can end up with biotin deficiency if you just use egg white. But that's what I do. I tend to use skyr yogurt. I'll use egg white if I need to fit, like Lewis put it down there, white fish is easy to over consume, like, because a lot of the time you just get so sick of chicken.
I'll drop you a message for your shape recipe.
Yeah, no worries. Andrew?
Hey, yeah, kind of playing off that same question. I don't know if it applies to anyone else right now, but I'm trying to keep calories pretty low and protein really high, carbs really low. So I am using a ton of whey protein, and I've always been pretty high dairy, a lot of non-fat Greek yogurt that's just loaded with protein. The easy fix to me, it seems I've kind of stuck with eating the same, few meats, broccoli, blueberries every day because they're really low calorie. But it's easy to diversify that. I guess I just wonder, if I'm not having issues with the dairy, the whey protein, the Greek yogurt, no worries or.
Yeah, I would generally say no worries. So, like, if someone's on an aggressive caloric deficit, I don't generally want to change anything.
No.
So, like, when I'm talking about like gut health, I'm not talking about it in the fat loss realm. So, like, if I've got someone like yourself who's like aggressively cutting, and I would be thinking to them, right, have you found like a food pattern that works for you now, and you don't feel
Yeah.
like crap? You found it, right? Just do that.
Right.
Do that until we're finished. You can worry about diversifying when you go back to maintenance or a surplus.
Sounds good. Thank you.
Nine. Anybody else? We good, gents? All right. Love to all. Have a great week, guys. Remember, if you're looking at Costa Rica, the link's there. You won't regret it. I'll speak to you all soon. Thank you all for joining me.
Appreciate you, Greg.
Thanks, Josh.
Thanks, Greg.